Always feel like we're on some epic journey with that music. We are. We are on an epic journey through the Bible. Thank you, Levi, and thank you, Becca, for that song. I love that song so much anyways, but it goes so perfectly with what we're going to talk about today, of God fighting our battles for us. Something I wanted to mention, they were in the pews last Sunday, but you remember all the way back Thanksgiving last year, I believe that's when we did this, collected an offering. We said the first $500 is going to go as seed money for our new pew Bibles. And definitely for those of you in the middle, I'm not sure how far it goes on the sides. I think they're more populated over here, but if you look in front of you, there is a new pew Bible there. They are amazing. And probably some of you are going to open it up and be like, I can't read this thing, dude. This is like 0.8 font, all right? I'm so sorry. I don't make pew Bibles, so that's what we're with. Our intention with these, like we said, is for you to be able to use them and enjoy them. And we got them specifically because it's a New Living Translation. That's what I preach out of. And so now I can do fun things like turn to page whatever. I've always wanted to do that, and now I can do that. But more importantly, what we want to do with these is anybody who does not have a Bible, that is our gift to you. That's our gift to them. They take those and they start experiencing God's word. That's what we want out of all of this. So take them and do an awe with them, but do not write in them and do not dog ear those pages. All right, I'm just kidding. You can do it. Like, don't do whatever you want, but it's a Bible. It's pages. So use them. They're there for your enjoyment. How about if you want to use one, you can pull it out and turn to Joshua chapter 6. That's what we'll read today. And if I was to tell you, hold on for just a minute. Some of you will beat me there. How many of you guys remember like growing up in church doing sword drills? Who could get there the fastest? That's me. I'm Joshua 6. Page 184 is where you'll be in those nice new Bibles if you want to use those. Many of you know we were at Florida this last week. We pulled into town at 4:30 in the morning yesterday, driving all the way through the night. Super smart, by the way. Let me tell you how awesome that is. Braden was praying for dinner last night. He said this line in his prayer. I just laughed at myself. Lord, please help Daddy stay awake during his sermon tomorrow. That just was like, if I put myself to sleep during a sermon, we've got some big old problems. So hopefully I don't put you to sleep this morning. Braden, I've got a picture there. Could you put that first picture up for me? How many of you remember playing this game from when you were younger or when your kids were younger? What is this game? Topple, all right? Now, I didn't play a lot of board games. I know, I'm sorry, Kennedys. I'm sorry, Woodards. I'm horrible. I didn't play a lot of board games. I'm a horrible childhood. I'm scarred. My parents didn't give me anything. Okay, we're done. I didn't play a lot of board games, but I did play some Topple in my day. If Topple is not your cup of tea, consider some other games with similar purposes. I've got a couple other pictures here on the next slide over. Yeah, it is, all right? There is a game, very, very similar. They look very similar. Blockhead or the Woodards introduced me to the game Bandu, all right? Which is actually very fun, all right? But all of these games have the same sort of point, objective, purpose. It's really simple. Each have their own little twist, but they want you to stack the blocks or stack the objects as high as you can, but inevitably we know what happens in the game, don't we? Crash. It always inevitably collapses. And today, guys, we're going to talk about a story. We're going to turn our attention and our walk through the Bible to a story that I think deserves extra special attention. Because more than a great crash, there's a truth that lies at the heart of this that I think is worth us stopping for just a moment and considering. And today, in our walk through the Bible, and I was telling Bible study group this morning that we have spent almost 3 months in two books, Genesis and Exodus. And we did that purposely. We slowed down to get through those books because they are so super, super critical and crucial to us understanding the rest of the Bible. So today, and you'll notice, you're like, whoa, hold on, Ryan. Genesis, and we did Exodus, and then you totally skipped three books, and now we're in Joshua. I know, and you can thank me later for that, by the way, all right? So we don't do anything in Leviticus. We don't do anything in Numbers. We don't do anything in Deuteronomy. We find ourselves in Joshua today. Don't you worry. Someday I'm coming back, and we're going to be Leviticus, all right? We're going to do it. I'm not a weenie. I'm not copping out. It's just not fitting with where we're going for this morning. Guys, Christians and non-Christians alike are familiar in some sense with this story in Joshua 6, even if the takeaways and the convictions of the story are vastly different. But before we launch into the story of Joshua and Jericho, it would do us really well to understand the context and what's going on around the story, some of the key points of this story. We spent a lot of time in Bible study this morning doing this very thing, and we went really deep in talking about what Jericho was. So we're going to just do like a little shallow. We're going to get in the shallow end of the pool, all right? Like 3 feet, all right? That's all we're going to do right now, all right? I don't have time to go really deep. Guys, Jericho is an important, and it still is a very important and central city and territory in all of human civilization. I have a picture up here. I have several different pictures, both modern day pictures and artist renderings of Jericho and what it possibly looked like in Joshua's day. It has the distinction of being the oldest continually inhabited city in the entire world in history. Some estimates have it being up to 10,000, even older than that. Even as far back as 10,000 BC, Jericho had people inhabiting it. It's also the lowest city as far as elevation is concerned in the world. I think it's about 600 or 800 feet below sea level. So I guess you could say that if you are in Jericho, you are simultaneously at the lowest and the highest points of human civilization. But even more important to what we're going to talk about this morning is that Jericho is positioned in a place in the Middle East that is a gateway to the Promised Land, what would become the Promised Land for the Israelites. And more specifically, it's a gateway to the Judean Mountains that would make up the heart of Israel's territory. And the fact that Israel shows up here in Joshua 6, actually before this in Joshua 1, they show up and they're camped across the Jordan and they see Jericho. The fact that they are at this spot is no mistake at all. God has them there for a purpose, both spiritually and militarily and strategically. It is a very advantageous position that cannot be ignored. If Israel was going to capture the hill country, they had to take Jericho first. It was the gateway. You do not go past Jericho and get any further without going through that. They would take Jericho, and then they would take another city that you could read about in Joshua 7, Ai, it was called. It was another town that stood at the ascent to these Judean mountains that they needed to get to. And from this position, as you can imagine, I don't know anything about military. I don't know anything about battle plans and what's really smart, but I know one thing that's super, super smart because I watch a lot of TV, and it says this. When you are fighting, you want to get to what? The high ground. That is the best place for you to be, is on the high ground. And I'm telling you guys this right here, to get through Jericho and to get in the mountains, they were on the high ground. And so they would get that, and by having control of that, they would have control of this central ridge in Judea. And what actually happened, and you don't catch this as you read the Bible, and what God was trying to do was he was trying to drive a wedge in the center of this territory so that they wouldn't be able to fight the battles to the south, and then fight the battles to the north. And effectively, what they did was they cut off the enemy right in the middle. They separated the enemy in the middle. It's a really genius strategy, but it's not one that Joshua would have come up with. Left to his own human devices and left to our devices, we would have gone about things in a completely different way than what God calls Joshua and the Israelites to do here in Joshua 6. It's very clear from the beginning, and we're going to pick up the story this morning actually in chapter 5, starting at verse 13 and read through verse 2 of chapter 6. It says, "When Joshua was near the town of Jericho, he looked up and saw a man standing in front of him with a sword in hand. Joshua went up to him and demanded, 'Are you friend or are you foe?' 'Neither one,' he replied. 'I am the commander of the Lord's army.'" And in fact, he's saying, "I am here on different business. I'm not on your timetable. I'm not here to serve you. I am the commander of the Lord's army. I am the commander of what you are about to do and going into Jericho and into Canaan." At this, Joshua fell with his face to the ground in reverence. "I am at your command," Joshua said. "What do you want your servant to do?" By the way, I just want to stop right there. It's a really, really great posture for any of us in life. We show up to God and we recognize, God, you are in control of this life right here. And we say those very words, "What do you want your servant to do?" The commander of the Lord's army replied, "Take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy." And Joshua did as he was told. Now the gates of Jericho were tightly shut because the people were afraid of the Israelites. It's very important. We're going to talk about that. No one was allowed to go out or to go in, but the Lord said to Joshua, I have given you Jericho, past tense. Now I'm going to give you Jericho. You will have Jericho. I have already given you Jericho. I have given you its king, and I have given you all of its strong warriors. Guys, this short section to open things up introduces us to the most important thing to gain from everything that we're going to talk about this morning. In fact, if we don't get this, you're not really going to get much of the rest of the story. The problem that we have most of the time when we come to stories like Joshua and Jericho is the problem that we have with many Bible stories. That they're just that. They're just stories with fun characters and nice, memorable plot lines that we gain a moral from. Usually, Joshua 6's moral, or the big takeaway, is whatever obstacle you are facing, you can take the town with enough of God's help. It's what some people have referred to as the Sunday schoolization of the Bible. You remember this story, don't you, and told in this way. My friends, they're coming up here in just a minute, maybe. There you go. You remember this, don't you? Anybody remember the VeggieTales story? It's actually called Josh and the Big Wall. How in the world could you ever forget a French-speaking accented pea on the top of a wall? And I think what happens sometimes is it's not that these depictions of the story are bad. They just really do a disservice to the story, because for most people, this is all they see of the story. A cutesy little story where God shows up and God rescues his people when they're in a really bad spot. So we have all of these stories, Veggie Tales and children's church songs, or the peppy Joshua fought the battle of Jericho and the walls came a-tumbling down. I sang that song, by the way, actually, in like a high school at a state competition. I remember singing that very song. And so we hear all this stuff and we see all this stuff and we're like, that's what the story is about. It's about walls coming down. Wherever you are in your life and you got an obstacle, you just look to God and have enough faith, and you believe enough, and walls will just come down. Well, that's certainly a part of the story, but I would argue it's actually a small part of the story. It's true that God does empower us and he does enable us to stare down some of our biggest obstacles and overcome them with his help, but that's not what this morning is all about. This story is not some peppy, cheery tale about you being able to do whatever God gives you the strength to do. Guys, I want you to understand this. Please write this down, put it in your mind, don't let it go. This is a story of God's holiness and his faithfulness to fulfill his promises. That's what Joshua and Jericho is all about. Don't miss it. Again, if you do, you have largely missed what this entire story is trying to instill in our hearts and in our minds. And we look at Joshua, and we're going to read some more about him, but I encourage you to read this story on your own, and you look at Joshua, and you're like, now that right there, that was a man's man. And he was. He was very different from Moses, his predecessor. He was all man. He was a military, he was a strategist. He was just so courageous. He had a courageous heart. He was defined by that. And from the very beginning, it's clear that God is calling Joshua to something that is way beyond his capacity. Even in all his manliness and him being so macho, what God calls him to do, he's like, whoa, there's no way I'm going to be able to do this. But the cause is very near to Joshua's heart. The first words, the very first words that God speaks to Joshua are this. Moses, my servant, is dead. Like there's no beating around the bush, just right to the point in a way that it seems God is saying to Joshua, son, It's time for you to step into my will for your life and to lead my people into the promised land. I mean, guys, talk about a really tall order. Number one, you are following possibly one of the greatest figures in all of Israel's history, Moses. Secondarily, you have probably anywhere between 1.5 to 3 million people around you that you've got to lead and wrangle. By the way, I just wrangled 3 kids for about a week in Florida, and it did me in. I'm done. How in the world he wrangled and led 1.5 to 3 million people is beyond my comprehension. Joshua displays, though, a willingness and a competency to show that he is up to the task, to this tall order. But guys, this is not a story about Joshua and his brilliance in military strategy. We really need in this story to see it in a fresh way and see whose battle this really is in Joshua chapter 6. Guys, it is the Lord's battle. He is the one that shows up. He is the one who fights. He is the one who wins. And you know what Israel is doing the whole time? Well, that was interesting. That was good. Like we usually look at the story like, oh, those Israelites, man. They had it all figured. Oh, they were so mean. And they just stormed that city. No, they didn't. Actually, God did everything in this story. And all Israel had to do was, all right, we're in the city. That's it. They did a fraction of the work. Guys, it is the Lord's battle. And he declares to Joshua, I want you to hear it again in verse 2. I, God, have given you Jericho, its king, and all its strong warriors. I want you to bear in mind what Hebrews says about this passage concerning Jericho. In Hebrews 11:30, we read these words. It was by their own courage. It was by their own smarts. It was by their own military skill that they took Jericho. No, what's it say? It was by faith that the people of Israel marched around Jericho and the walls came crashing down. Guys, this whole thing for the nation of Israel was a walk of faith. It's about God building faith into the hearts of his people. It is God who is the one who is active, who does every single thing in this story. The famous story of the collapse of the city of Jericho is all about faith. And not just like blind faith, not just some leap of faith, faith in the promises of God and that he will fulfill the promises that he makes to us. Because the walls of this formidable city fell because Joshua and the people of Israel believed God. It's as simple as that. I mean, like, you're like, really? That's all you got for me this morning? Nothing amazing? No fireworks? No. It's just as simple and basic and elementary as that. But you know what? We so often forget it in our lives, don't we? Just believe. Just have faith. The Israelites honored God by trusting him to act on their behalf. And whenever God is honored, God acts. I want to say that again. I want you to hear that. Like, what in the world do I need to do in my life to have God show up and do something in my life? Something maybe even miraculous in my life. When you honor God and have faith in God and obey God, then God shows up and God acts. So maybe if you are asking yourself in your life, well, why, Ryan, why am I not seeing God show up and do things in my life? I don't know. Maybe because you are not honoring God in some way in your life by not doing something he's calling you to do or doing something that he's calling you not to do. Abraham Lincoln was once asked if God was on his side during the Civil War, and he said this, and I love this line, "Sir, I am not so concerned whether or not God is on my side, rather I am concerned whether or not I am on his side." This is a question we usually ask in our lives and want to know in our lives. Like, God, are you for me? For me, or are you against me? Instead, the question we need to ask is, are we for and with God or not. The commander here in Joshua 5 says, I am here to fight God's battle. Whose side are you on, Joshua? I'm not here as a lieutenant. I am here as the general and the commander. I am in charge here, which brings us to a really super important question I want you to consider as we're going along this morning. How do you usually see God in your life? Do you see God as someone who can influence you and guide you and comfort you and take care of you and help you through tough times? Guys, God wants to do all of those things in your life. He wants to bless you and He wants to take care of you. But do you know how God first comes into your life and how God wants to be seen in your life primarily? As Lord. Guys, you cannot have Jesus or the Christ part of Him if you don't first take Him as Lord, Commander, in charge of your life, every aspect of your life. It is Lord of all, or it's not Lord at all in your life. Jesus doesn't come to be a part of your life. He comes to take the whole thing over. I think sometimes we so incredibly miss that. There are some of you in here, there are some of you watching at home who in your life, all these years later, have still never surrendered control of your life over to God. And because of that, you are missing out on so much. C.S. Lewis once said that coming to Jesus and surrender and seeing Him as Lord is kind of like living in this old, rickety, beat-up house where a lot of stuff doesn't work. And you're like thinking, well, that's my house. That's my house. A lot of stuff doesn't work. And so Jesus comes into this house and He gets to work. He fixes the leaks and He patches the roof and He unplugs the drains and things are really great. And then God rips out an entire wall in the house and you're like, whoa, hold on. What are you doing? But then you realize that there's some really nice shiplap underneath it, and you're like, whoa, okay, keep going. All right, that's awesome. Or maybe, you know, he rips up some of that shag carpet in the house, and there are beautiful, pristine hardwood floors underneath it. And you're like, whoa, keep going, God. But then He starts tearing down whole sections of the house, and you're like, whoa, what is happening? C.S. Lewis says it this way, the explanation is that He is building quite a different house from the one that you thought of. He's launching out on a new wing here. He's putting up an extra floor there. He's running up towers. He's making courtyards. You thought that you were being made into a decent little cottage, but He is building a palace. And He intends to come and to live in it Himself. Guys, God had a better plan for Joshua. God had a better plan for Israel. He's got a better plan for you. He's got a better plan for me. And it starts, guys, with total and utter surrender in your lives that He is Lord. And we look at Joshua and we think to ourselves, like, but where in the world did Joshua get all of his strength and all of his confidence? Guys, it didn't come from him intrinsically. It didn't come from his own toughness. It didn't come from his own strength, but it came from beliefs that determined his behavior. And there are some really important things that show up in Joshua's life. And I want to kind of highlight them this morning. I think the first thing is that Joshua had a belief that God was all-powerful. I mean, Joshua is very unique in Israel. Remember, let me just kind of do a little bit of a rewind and catch us up here. Joshua and his buddy Caleb are the only ones who have come through the wilderness, through 40 years in the wilderness, and they're about ready to step into the promised land. Everybody else in that generation has died off. Joshua has seen firsthand from boyhood on all of the mighty miracles of God that He performed. 10 plagues, the Red Sea, bitter water into sweet water, manna and quail that we've talked about. For the last 40 years, Joshua was an eyewitness to the clear power of God, but also God's willingness to bear that power on behalf of His people for their good. And because of this, and everything that Joshua had seen, and all the power that Joshua had seen from God, he believes and he knows that there is nothing that is too difficult or insurmountable for God. Joshua also believed that God would always keep His promises. Doesn't matter how foolish or how crazy or how wild things seemed. And it's going to get wild here in just a minute, guys. He says, I believe, God, that you keep your promises. Guys, do we believe that God keeps his promises? Joshua knew well God's promise. All the way back at Genesis 12, any good Israelite, any good Jew would know what God said to Abraham. I'm going to give you many descendants, and I will give you land. And now Joshua, just stop for a minute and think about this and close your eyes. All of Joshua that he's experienced, all that he knows about what God has said to Abraham, and now he is standing on the edge of that promise on the banks of the Jordan. The promise that he had given to Abraham and to Isaac and to Jacob would now be fulfilled in the life and the leadership of Joshua. I mean, guys, talk about pressure. You think you've lived in some sort of pressure in your life? Imagine that kind of immense pressure on you. I want to press on this one a little more, though, because it's a key spiritual insight into what's ultimately going to determine for victory for Israel and what determines victory for you and I in our lives. And this is so incredibly important. I feel like I've said this within the last few weeks, but I want to say it again and say it in a different way. Because we show up this story and we read this story and we think about our lives, and Joshua and you and I, we fight from victory. We don't fight just for victory. I think sometimes we do that. And especially sometimes we do that as Christians, like we gotta fight every battle, man. We gotta go out there and just fight. We gotta argue. No. This is a whole shift in mindset. We in our lives, and especially as Christians, do not fight just for victory. We largely fight from victory. Everything has already been won. Everything has already been decided. That's what happens here in Joshua 6 when he shows up to Jericho. I have given you Jericho. Guys, we stand in a place of guaranteed victory. Maybe not in the moment, but eternally we do. Because Jesus has already defeated the enemy way back. It's already been done. It's already been settled. It's already been won. The story has already been written. We know the end. Joshua and the Israelites were fighting from this same advantageous position. If you were to look back into Joshua 2, and specifically verses 9 through 11, it starts talking about this. When the spies go to visit Rahab, it says this. Rahab says, I know the Lord has given you this land. Like, what better, like, green light, go, you can do this, do you need, than somebody? Your enemy telling you, hey, guess what? We know we're toast. Attack. That's the time right there. She says, we know that he's given you this land. We're all afraid of you. Everyone in the land is living in terror, for we have heard how the Lord made a dry path. He's done all these things. He led you out of Egypt. We know what he did to Sihon and Og over on the east side of the Jordan. No wonder our hearts have melted in fear. No one has the courage to fight after hearing such things. For the Lord your God is the supreme God of the heavens above and the earth below. That is an all-powerful God who has already fought the battle for his people. Like, could you imagine that, guys? Joshua and the Israelites, all they have to do is they have to march around knowing we've already won. We don't have to do a single thing except for what God calls us to do. Nothing more, nothing less. Do exactly what God says. I have given you Jericho. And now all Joshua and Israel have to do is stand on that promise and obey. Guys, victorious Christianity is, and victorious Christians are, those who know the promises of God because they spend time meditating on God's word. And they believe the promises because that word generates hope in their hearts. Finally activating those promises and acting on becoming obedient to what God calls them to do. See, we don't come to this and we read this and be like, well, that's a really neat story. No. God is always calling us to something. Mostly and mainly, he's calling us, be obedient to what I am saying in my word. That's how you live in victory. As we stand on the truth of God's word and his promises, we can face the spiritual battles that face us because God is with us. No situation is too much for him to handle. No problem is too big for him to solve. But again, guys, the moral of this story is not that if we just trust enough, we can do anything. We're invincible. We can take any town. We can take anything. But the moral is that if we reckon on the strength of God, we live from the position of a battle already won versus a battle to be fought. Guys, I'm sickened, and I am tired, and I am done. Not just with this world and with this country, but especially with Christians that just cannot understand that. I understand that we get frustrated. I understand that we get tired. I understand that we get worn down. I understand that we're attacked every single day, but why in the world are we surprised by that? We are told all over Scripture that's going to be the case. What would change in our lives if we just said, you know what? Battle's already been won. I don't need to fight. I don't need to be nasty. I don't need to be mean. I don't even need to make myself look like a donkey. Battle's already been won. It's over. It's decided. It's sealed. Francis Schaeffer, a theologian, once said, Joshua did not take the city of Jericho merely by a clever human military tactic. The strategy was all the Lord's. Because if you go back to Joshua 1, and I believe I heard Luke up here and he's reading some of Joshua 1, there are some really important words that God gives to Joshua. He is essentially saying to him at the very beginning of his call, I want you, Joshua, to be strong with my strength. I want you to be courageous with my courage. So Joshua believed that his God was all-powerful. He believed that God will fulfill his promises. And the other thing that Joshua believed, among many things, was that God would always be with him. Again, looking back at Joshua chapter 1, specifically verses 5 and 9, it says this, no one will be able to stand against you as long as you live, for I will be with you as I was with Moses. I will not fail you. I will not abandon you. Verse 9, this is my command. Be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid or be discouraged, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. God will be present with you. This isn't just for Joshua, guys. This is for us too. God is with you wherever you go. He will not fail you. It is God's presence and God's presence alone that is decisive in toppling Jericho. I want to read on in our story here. Still got your finger there on Joshua 6, starting and picking up again at verse 3. You and your fighting men should march around the town once a day for 6 days. 7 priests will walk ahead of the ark, each carrying a ram's horn. On the 7th day, you are to march around the town 7 times with the priest blowing the horns. When you hear the priest give one long blast on the ram's horn, have all the people shout as loud as they can. Then the walls of the town will collapse and the people can charge straight into the town. So Joshua called together the priests and said, and notice this, Joshua never gives orders directly to the people. He gives it to the priests, he gives it to the commanders, and he says, take up the ark of the Lord's covenant and assign 7 priests to walk in front of it, each carrying a ram's horn. Then he gave orders to the people. And he says, this is what you're going to do. It's the only order that you're going to get. And by the way, this is a really strange order. March around the town and the armed men will lead the way in front of the ark of the Lord. That's it, done. That's really frustrating, by the way, isn't it? I don't know about you, but my life, I want really detailed plans. Thank you, God. Tell me the when, tell me the why, tell me the where, tell me everything about it. It says, nope, this is all you get. You're going march. That's it. March. After Joshua spoke to the people, the 7 priests with the ram's horn started marching in the presence of the Lord, blowing the horns as they marched, and the ark of the Lord's covenant followed behind them. Some of the armed men marched in front of the priests with the horns and some behind the ark with the priests continually blowing the horns. This is silly. Do not shout. Don't even talk, Joshua commanded. Not a single word from any of you until I tell you to shout. Then you'll shout. So the ark of the Lord was carried around the town once that day, and then everyone returned to spend the night in the camp. Joshua got up early the next morning, and the priests again carried the ark of the Lord. The 7 priests with the ram's horn marched in the front of the ark, blowing their horns. Again, the armed men marched both in front of the priests with the horns and behind the ark of the Lord. All this time, the priests were blowing their horns. And then verse 14, on the 2nd day, they again marched around the town once and returned to the camp. They followed this pattern for 6 days. I just want you to imagine this and stop for just a moment. Marching, marching, marching. All right, I'm going to go back to camp. Don't say anything. It's just kind of silly. Do you ever think there was a moment that at least one of them had been like, what in the world are we doing? this looks so goofy. It is really significant, by the way, as we're talking here about knowing that God was going to be with Joshua. It's significant that the ark that symbolizes God's presence is mentioned 8 times in the verses we just read, no less than 8 times, signifying that we can make all the noise that we want, we can march for as long as we want, but if the Lord is not in it, it's not going to make a bit of difference. If the Lord is not present, it doesn't matter a whole lot. Guys, Joshua and Israel listened to God, believing what he said. They moved on his orders, but God did all of the heavy lifting. The ark would be prominent in this victory, even as it was in the crossing of the Jordan River. Israel had to keep their hearts and their minds on the Lord who was present with them, instead of putting their hearts and their minds on the difficulty of the task in front of them. And so Joshua believed God's power and his promises and his presence. What more does a person need to stand strong in their faith? And if you really think about it, you see that virtually every issue in life, as well as every obstacle and circumstance and problem, comes down to a question of faith. What do you believe? Who do you believe? There's some really important things that show up, and I want to focus on one of these here, and it's this concept. In verse 10, he says, "Do not shout, do not talk, don't say a single word until I tell you to shout." Guys, this must have been an insanely difficult thing to do. It's completely contrary to every war practice back in that day. You know what the practice was of wars back in that day? You make as much noise as you can, because what do you want to do? You want to intimidate the enemy, don't you? So they show up. Not a single word. That's eerie. That's weird, by the way. I mean, shoot, guys, some of us have a problem being quiet for 6 minutes, let alone 6 days. And now, it's possible, I think it's likely, that not all 2 to 3 million Israelites are marching on Jericho, but there's still a hefty number of people, to be sure. I mean, have you ever tried to keep a group of people quiet? Like, Levi's like, yeah, I tried to keep my class quiet. It doesn't happen. I mean, even if you feel like you've got all of the talking done, there's always just this, like, this low hum of noise and just something going on, a smattering of noise happening. Guys, to keep a group this large silent was no small task. Guys, silence before God is a lesson I think all of us would do well to learn. Luis Palau says it this way: "What a rare commodity. How difficult this is to achieve. If we're not speaking verbally, then there are 1,000 mental voices inside our thoughts, each vying for the last word. Listen to God. How can he possibly get a word in edgewise?" This passage in Joshua 6 seems to be saying, hush. Don't talk so much. Be quiet before the Lord after you've poured out your heart to him. Let God speak. This is a very important part of this story. And we can answer a lot of questions. Why? Why in the world was silence so important? But I think it just suffices to say that when God has spoken, when God has determined something, just shut up. Just shut up. Stop talking. So I think the biggest thing is to take away from that. There is, though, a really big elephant, I would call it, in the room that shows up in this story. And it happens in the next, in the closing verses that we're going to talk about this morning, verse 15. On the 7th day, the Israelites got up at dawn and marched around the town as they had done before, but this time they went around 7 times. The 7th time around, as the priests sounded the long blast on their horns, Joshua commanded the people, "Shout, for the Lord," here it is again, "the Lord has given you the town." And then here it is, verse 17. "Jericho and everything in it must be completely destroyed as an offering to the Lord. Only Rahab the prostitute and the others in her house will be spared, for she protected our spies. Don't take any of the things set apart for destruction." Spoiler alert, go read Joshua 7. They do that very thing. One man does. Don't take anything set apart for destruction, or you will be completely destroyed. You will bring trouble on the camp of Israel. Everything made from silver, gold, bronze, or iron is sacred to the Lord, must be brought into his treasury. When the people heard the sound of the ram's horns, they shouted as loud as they could, and suddenly the walls of Jericho collapsed, and the Israelites charged straight into the town and captured it. I mean, you see the line, don't you? Jericho and everything in it must be completely destroyed. Guys, this is just incompatible with most people's sensibilities. And if you shrink back at this moment in the Bible, you're not alone, but we have to deal with it head on. So what in the world is this all about? Because understanding this is really one of the keys to unlocking the meaning of such an odd moment. And first off, and this is what I want to say, reading the Bible is like being invited over to someone's home for dinner who is not a part of your culture. I mean, what would it be like if you went into someone's house and you demanded, "I want a hamburger. I don't care what else you got, I want a hamburger, man." When they're intending to fix a lovely Asian dish or an Indian dish or some other exotic dish from another culture that we're not familiar with. Guys, we often approach the Bible like that, trampling all over the Bible and demanding that it say what we want it to say and answer questions that it doesn't intend to answer. Just as it's rude to import ourselves into someone hosting us in their home, so it is rude to do the same thing with the Bible in our lives. And what I'm trying to say, guys, in a really basic sense, is that the Bible deals with cultures and languages and practices that are so foreign to us that we have to approach it with humility to understand that while we don't understand a particular way of doing things, I don't understand, God, why you have to destroy everything in the path. We have the sense that we just let the Bible speak and we listen and we learn. And in Joshua 6, we apply this by understanding that the command to completely destroy was not a new command. God didn't just come up with this magically right on the spot. It was actually a command that was given to Moses many years before, 400 plus years before this. Why? Why did God say this? Why did God do this? And it's because of this, guys. This was not an innocent nation or town. They did unspeakably wicked things. Oh, try this one on for size. It was very common practice for the Canaanites and the people in Jericho to sacrifice their children by having them walk through fire. Does that sound wonderful and rosy to you? No. G. Campbell Morgan put it this way. God is perpetually at war with sin, and that is the whole explanation of the extermination of the Canaanites. In a secondary sense, as we look at this, guys, Canaan had every opportunity, an ample amount of time to turn to God, going all the way back to the time of Abraham. In Genesis 15, 16, God says to Abraham, "I'm not going to let you have this land yet because the sin of the people is not great enough." It had finally become great enough over 400 years later. The practice that's used here in Joshua 6 of complete destruction is the Hebrew idea, the Hebrew word harim, which is not so much judgment on a land or specifically here on Jericho as it is protection for Israel from their disgusting practices and their persuasive teachings. And it still begs the question, and some of you are asking, Ryan, wait. Was Canaanite religion so attractive and Israel's faith so fragile that it called for complete destruction and annihilation? And for that answer to that question, we only need to keep reading and find out that the answer to that question is a resounding yes. Go read the rest of the Old Testament. Was their religion very intriguing and very alluring to the Israelites? Absolutely it was. It got them in trouble time and time again. Because there's nothing ethnic, there's nothing racial, there's nothing genocidal about this destruction. It is all about the danger of sin. Again, G. Campbell Morgan would say this, "Thank God that he will not make peace with sin in my heart. Bless his name for the thunder of his authority and for the profound conviction that he is fierce and furious in his anger about sin." God does not take it lightly and he does not play with sin. This was not about wanton killing and bloodthirsty Israelites. This is about a God teaching his people a lesson that would serve them well in the conquest that lay before them. Guys, God did a really awesome thing at Jericho. And often it's taught that it's a case that God takes down some massive walls so that Israel can win. Guys, it's a case where God stepped in when Israel and Joshua needed them. But here is the thing. Here's the thing that we really need to understand about this story. I said this in Bible study this morning. The city itself, Jericho, the area inside the walls of Jericho, was about 5 to 6 acres. In total, the whole area was about 10 to 12 acres. There were not a lot of people there. Possibly a population of about 1,500 people, all the way up to about 3,000 people. There is nowhere near the number of people to fight against Israel. And when people learn this, they're often really confused. And their assumption is usually, if God gives miraculous victories when his people are up against insurmountable obstacles, what in the world is going on here? If it's not about war, and it's not about killing, and it's not about God showing dominance or the Israelites showing their dominance, what is really going on here? And this is where we really get to the heart of this story. We really get to the connection of what this means for us today. What's really going on in the story is that Israel is getting a lesson in God being with them. Because if Israel wanted God to fight for them, if they wanted to watch him tear down walls, they had to obey. They had to believe. They had to believe that he gives promises and he fulfills promises. Significantly, this lesson was given when they were under minimal threat. There was really no threat at Jericho. They could have trampled that city and kept on going. But God says, nope, I want you to sit there. I want you to watch. I'm going to fight this for you. That's minimal threat. And he does this before they enter the fray of truly difficult and major battles that are going to come their way. Guys, we shouldn't read the Battle of Jericho as if Israel was terrified of the city and that God just whooshes in and he saves the day. Instead, we should read this story as a case where God stepped in during the warm-up, as it were, to set Israel up for success for the days to come. Guys, the judgment was fierce, the wrath was real, but there is something symbolic and instructive that is happening here in this story. There are larger things at play. How do I know that? Very quickly, let me just tell you about some of the significant things in the story that we often overlook. For starters, in God's plan to take Jericho, there is a very significant focus on the number seven. Seven priests, seven trumpets, 7 days of marching, seven laps on the seventh day. Guys, the number seven holds very sacred significance in the life of Israel. The Sabbath is celebrated on the seventh day. It's 7 weeks from Passover to Pentecost. The seventh year is the sabbatical year. And after 49 years, you guessed that seven times seven, comes the year of Jubilee, which is a signification and a celebration of liberty and freedom. The Hebrew word translated seven comes from a word that means to be full or to be satisfied. Also significant in this story is the idea that the trumpets that are used in the siege. Silver trumpets in the life of Israel were always used to signify something important was about to happen, but silver trumpets are not used here. What does it say? It's a ram's horn that is used. Ram's horns were always used in Israel's history for something that had already happened. And here is where all of this comes together in this story, guys. Israel is not declaring war in Joshua 6 because there was no war to speak of. The Jews were celebrating a jubilee, a freedom in a new land, because after 7 days of marching, God was going to finish and bring to completion what he had started. The promise that he had given back to Abraham in Genesis 12, he was fulfilling it now here. Guys, it's all about God fulfilling and keeping a promise in spite of rampant darkness closing in on that promise. And the biggest feature, I don't want you to miss this, it's right there at the very end what we read, the biggest feature of that promise is redemption. Guys, this is the ultimate reason that I know God is up to something bigger than mindlessly killing people. In the story, the wrath and the justice and the mercy of God meet and come together. Jericho and everything in it must be destroyed, but one thing, one person. Who? Rahab. Rahab the prostitute will be spared. Not only was she saved, but she became the heiress to King David and eventually to the Messiah. Guys, in Joshua 6, you have this really, really wonderful picture of a whole city that is doomed to destruction, but of God's grace to someone who believed in the God of Israel, that he was the true God. Grace is given to Rahab. You have this little gem amongst all of this wickedness. Guys, in truth, if you were to go back to Joshua chapter 2 and the spies go in and they talk to Rahab, why in the world were the spies there? I'm convinced that they were not there to spy out the land. They already knew what was in the land. They already knew what lay before them. I think that they were there in large part to save Rahab and anybody else who would believe by gathering with her. And in the end, this Old Testament historical narrative points beyond itself to a greater Joshua. A Joshua who will deliver judgment, but the book also paints a picture of mercy. A prostitute of all people. Her family, those who were in her house, they were the only ones who were saved in Jericho. Guys, think about this. Rahab had a really, really difficult decision to make. Either she turned the two men over and she would be rewarded probably by the king, but if she hid them, she would be committing treason, and if the king discovered that, she would be put to death. But that's exactly what she did. That's the risk that she took. Why in the world would she do that? It's because while the hearts of the rest of the people melted in fear, Rahab's heart was melted into faith. She wanted in on God's grace and on God's goodness. Guys, the judgment on the Canaanite city of Jericho is horrific. I cannot say it any other way. But someone was spared. And guys, that is the most spectacular truth of the entire story. A truth that has wide and deep ramifications this morning. Anybody who has not come into a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. Guys, there is no missing that the leader of God's people here in our story this morning is Joshua. Or in Hebrew, the word is Yeshua. God is salvation. Or when translated into English, Jesus. Guys, don't miss that important little nugget. It's a massive, massive boulder. The one who will lead them and save them here at the start and all throughout the conquest is Joshua in name, but it really is Jesus in reality. For us, guys, Jesus Christ is the greater Joshua. At Calvary and at the empty tomb, God, through Christ, decisively defeated humanity's bitterest enemies, sin and death. And as such, we fight in the same confidence that Israel had in marching around Jericho. We go on knowing that Jesus already has the enemy on the run. I'm going to ask the worship team to come back up here. Guys, as with the people of Israel, so it is with us today. It comes down to a matter of faith. What do you believe and who do you believe? It's a hope that we believe in God's presence, that He will never leave us and He will never forsake us, that we believe in His power, that we serve a God who is able to do exceedingly abundantly beyond all that we ask or think according to the power that is at work within us. And we believe in the promises to us in Jesus Christ, that our God cannot lie, that our God cannot fail to fulfill His word. Above all, I want you to take heart, guys, that you are not fighting any battles. You are not fighting for victory because, guys, the battle belongs to the Lord, and it's already been decided.